Chapter 4. Dreamland. It's a bright, crisp afternoon. My spirits have lifted, along with the usual November overcast. I have a feeling my luck will change today, too. Leisurely driving amongst the skeletons of dead cornfields in a daydream of flight, I begin to wonder if I'll ever run into Dan or Rich again. I figure on a day like today, they'll be out in their planes enjoying the pleasant weather. It doesn't take long before I spot a familiar-looking blue plane flying from left to right, not too far out in front of my truck. I zigzag through the fields, managing to follow its track. Ignoring the no trespassing and keep out signs posted along the way, my chase leads me down a private gravel road back to a quaint farm. By the time I find where the plane has landed, its engine is already shut off. I recognize the tall pilot. It's Dan. Bundled in a bulky flight suit, wearing gloves and a scarf draped around his neck, he's just getting up out of the cockpit of his plane. Gazing around the farm, I'm stunned by the surroundings. I've entered a different world, an era lost in time. With my truck engine silent, the setting has an eerie quality to it. Bordering the property is a weathered wooden fence. To the west of a lush green runway is a line of willow trees which delicately sway in the easy breeze. Far to the east are the snow-capped Sierra Nevada mountains. Stationed next to the landing strip on top of a large white hangar is a faded orange windsock that hunts endlessly for the wind's origin. I raise a hand in greeting as I climb out of my truck and venture over to have a better look at Dan's plane. I quickly appreciate the meticulous care evident in its construction. This plane is not just a toy. Its simple, lightweight design appears sturdy and reliable. Dan must take great pride in his fine flying machine. With all of the research I've done on ultralights, I'm eager to finally get a chance to talk to one of these guys again. Walking toward Dan, I say, "Hi there. If you have a minute, do you mind if I ask you about your plane?" Eyeing me with skepticism, Dan replies, "No, I don't mind, but how did you find this place? We don't have many people wandering back here." Do you remember that day you and your buddy were dropping watermelons? Well, I was the guy who stopped to watch you. I was impressed with your planes and was really hoping to find you guys to ask some more questions. By the way, my name is Mark, Mark Thomas. Unlocking the huge door to the hangar, he replies, "Well, nice to meet you, Mark. I'm Daniel Martin. You can call me Dan." Mounted above the door is an odd-looking homemade sign. In large letters it reads, "Area 52, Top Secret Military Installation." Below in a smaller font it reads, "Welcome to Dreamland." The real Dreamland is known as Area 51, a top secret military base located north of Las Vegas. The Air Force controls the base, and it's known for testing exotic aircraft, and is rumored to house UFOs. Shaking my head a little, I mutter, "Who are these guys, and what the heck am I getting myself into?" Inside the hangar, I can see Rich's green plane way in the back. The place is clean and well-lit. It has workbenches, shelves stocked with airplane parts, a refrigerator, some comfy chairs, and even a nice stereo system. This hangar looks like a comfortable place to spend some time. Dan is extremely helpful and patient with all of my questions. We discuss many aspects of sport flying, including methods for assembling the plane and flying lessons. As he carefully pushes his plane into the hangar, I tell him, "You know, I've read up a lot on your model of ultralight, and it appears to have the best safety record in the industry. I'm thinking about ordering a kit for a plane just like yours." Surprised, Dan studies me with interest. "Huh, no kidding. Sometimes when Rich and I are out flying, we get people interested in our planes, but few ever follow up on their dreams of flight because the sport requires such a large commitment, which," he pauses to look directly at me, "if you're serious, you'll soon discover for yourself." Assembling a new plane would require a space bigger than my garage because the plane's wingspan is over 30 feet. Although I've been anxious to get started on my own plane, I haven't been able to find the space to accommodate my project. I tell Dan, "I've been out to the local general aviation airport, but there are no hangars available." "Yeah, you sure you want to do this?" he asks. I tell him of my obsession over the last few months, countless hours scouring the internet, bookstores, and aviation magazines. Apparently impressed with my tenacity, Dan offers, "If you're that committed, I can invite you to join us in our hangar. We have room for one more plane, and you can help pay the rent on the building. I'll even help you with some of the more difficult portions of the assembly." This generosity is more than I expected or even hoped for. Excited by this new prospect and wanting to know more, I ask, "Do you and Rich own this property?" Wiping the exhaust residue from the propeller with an old rag, Dan informs me, "No, the property's owned by a special old gal who's an aviation fanatic from way back. She used to be quite a pilot years ago, but she's no longer able to fly. She likes watching our small planes buzzing around, though, and occasionally we take her along for a flight. She spends most of her time reading and attending to her tropical pet birds." Motioning to the other end of the runway, Dan continues, "That's her house over there. Every once in a while, she'll come over and join in on the hangar flying. Her name's Amelia, and this private airstrip's known to the small society of ultralight pilots in the area as Dreamland. Rich and I pay a modest rent and help out around the property, taking care of Amelia's place and keeping up the grass runway." The luscious grass landing strip is manicured like a golf course, and from a short distance, it looks like an inviting soft sea of green. Dreamland is indeed a good description for the place. It's an ideal setting for a private airstrip. And like the fabled Area 51 Dreamland in the Nevada desert, this place too has strange vehicles and secret operations conducted far from public view. That night at home, I describe Dreamland to Jennifer and Shannon. Excitedly, I tell them everything Dan said. I may be a little too in touch with my inner child, but I can no longer help myself. After dinner, Shannon retreats to her room to catch up on the day's gossip with her girlfriends on the phone. Taking advantage of the privacy, I explain to Jennifer the plan I've been formulating. "You know, I've been reading a lot about flying. Maybe I'm being a little impulsive, but I think I'm ready to order a kit for a plane. According to Dan, it's pretty easy to assemble. It only takes a few weeks to put together, and he said he'd help me with the hard parts. When I'm done, he says he can teach me how to fly, too." I couldn't ask for a more understanding mate than Jennifer. Over the years, she's put up with my obsessions and encouraged me even when she had her doubts about my endeavors. Now, true to her character, she smiles and calmly responds, "Mark, you know I support you on this. I've seen how careful you are with everything else you've ever done. I know you're prepared. If this is what you want, then I think you should go ahead and pursue it. I've given it a lot of thought, you know. I've weighed the pros and cons, and I just can't get it out of my mind." Laughing, I remind her of the time she insisted on redecorating our kitchen. She spent weeks puzzling over tile and countertops, faucets and cabinet faces. She forced me to look at countless paint and wallpaper samples, and generally became a pest to Shannon and me before she was finally satisfied with a design. Promising to spare her that kind of badgering, I ask, "So you don't mind if I order it tomorrow? It's really not too expensive." Jennifer wisecracks, "Okay, but as long as I get to pick out a nice big diamond ring." Giving me a warm smile and a hug, she says, "Just kidding, honey. Go order your airplane." The next day at the office, I make the call to the manufacturer. My hands shake while I give my credit card number and shipping information. Everyone in the office thinks I'm nuts, but what's new? That night I could hardly sleep, thinking about how my life will change. I'll be busy with this new endeavor, but if I schedule my time wisely, I shouldn't have to sacrifice too much time away from my family. Since the clinic's been making good money lately, I rationalize that I can also reduce my workload a little. 2 weeks later, Christmas arrives early for me. Instead of colorfully wrapped presents delivered by sleigh, my packages are large plain cardboard boxes brought by a big brown truck. I'm no less excited by their arrival than a 6-year-old on Christmas morning. I sit there for a while and stare at those boxes to consider the magic they surely hold. The very next weekend, I haul the boxes containing my new airplane parts out to the hangar. Dan is already there at Dreamland, tinkering on his plane's engine. Rich's plane is gone, and Dan shows me which part of the hangar to unload at and claim as my own. An old woman drives up in a red Volkswagen Bug, and I wonder if this could be our landlord with the rental agreements for me to sign. The woman is dressed in a tropical flowered blouse and baggy beige slacks. She gets out of the car and walks slowly and carefully over to the hangar's entrance. She's fairly tall and probably in her 80s or early 90s. She has a weathered, familiar-looking face with a faint scar on her forehead. She has many wrinkles, but somehow they work for her. She's tan, trim, and healthy-looking. Envisioning her as a younger woman, I figure she probably had her share of attention from men in her day. "Hey, Dan, is this your new hangar mate?" the woman calls out. Dan walks out and greets her with a big friendly hug. "Hey, Amelia, how are you doing?" "Yeah, this here's Mark. I told you about him. He's new to sport flying, and he just got a new kit to build. Amelia has a demure smile, and her eyes squint from the light of the sun. She lowers her hand from shading her face and cordially offers it to me. Nice to have you aboard. My name's Amelia. Her hand is soft yet firm in mine. As she releases our clasp, I say, Nice to meet you, Amelia. I feel darn lucky to have found this place, and Dan's making me feel at home here. Good to hear. You can work out the rent payments with Dan and Rich. All I ask is that when you get ready to fly, you just don't buzz too low over my neighbors. I hope you enjoy yourself, and just be careful. Other than that, maybe offer me a ride once in a while, she says with a wink. I instantly feel welcome here. Dan is generous, and Amelia has a unique motherly charisma about her. She mentions something about feeding her birds and then slowly motors off in her bug. That's a great landlord you got there, I say to Dan. Laughing, he says, You mean that's a great landlord we've got? Hey, Dan, I couldn't help notice the scar on Amelia's forehead. Did she get that flying? And it's none of my business, but what kind of flying did she do anyway? Dan considers this for a moment, then says, Well, Mark, all she's told me was that she used to fly all over the place, and that she got the scar in a little mishap while flying a long time ago. She says she's a widow and that her husband left her enough money to live on this farm, far away from nosy people. She likes the peace and quiet out here, except, of course, for our planes. I think she wishes she had one herself. I know from my dad's history lessons that Amelia Earhart attempted a daring round-the-world flight long ago. She left Oakland, California back in 1937 in a big aluminum twin-engine tail dragger. Her course took her east to Florida, across the Atlantic over Africa, Asia, Australia, and over the Pacific. But she vanished somewhere near Howland Island in the South Pacific, never to be heard from again. I wished my father were here. I bet he'd have some questions to ask. And now that Dan piqued my interest, I can't avoid inquiring. Let me get this straight. Amelia's an old gal with a mysterious past who used to be a pilot. Come on, Dan. What's the real story here? Again, Dan takes his time responding, and with a wry smile adds, You believe what you want, Mark. Rich has his own theory, but mind you, Rich is a little out there. I think he even believes in UFOs and stuff. Anyway, he thinks Amelia's the real deal. He says she got her scar from crashing her plane at Howland Island during her round-the-world attempt. Rich swears he read somewhere that Howard Hughes, also an accomplished pilot, organized a secret search and recovery mission to find Miss Earhart. He believes Hughes did indeed find her living on the island, and he brought her back. Rich thinks they secretly got married, and that when Hughes died, she bought this farm and has lived out here ever since. In a disbelieving tone, I say, No way, you guys are full of it. Dan replies, You probably got that right. Listen, we have a good setup here. We have a great place to keep our planes, and Amelia's about the best landlord you could ask for. I've never pushed her much about her past. She's kind of reluctant to talk too much about it, but I'm okay with it. Heck, she's probably just a senile old lady in her own fantasy world. That's fine by me. Trying to settle down a bit, I remark, All right, Dan, I'll let it go. She's really friendly, and I can tell she's the type who enjoys airplanes and takes a lot of pride in her little piece of heaven here. As I get back to unloading my boxes, the hangar stereo plays old hits from the big band era on a scratchy AM station. We hear songs from Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong. When I question him, Dan says the radio reception is poor inside the hangar, and ironically, that's the only station they can get. Laying flat on the hangar floor next to Dan and his plane is an old German Shepherd. It lies quietly, never moving from the spot. After Dan helps unload my boxes, I kneel down to say hello to his dog. What's your dog's name? His name's Jetlag. I adopted him from a shelter about 5 years ago, and he's never been what I would call real spunky. After examining the dog's teeth, eyes, and hips, I can see that Jetlag has a congenital disease common among German Shepherds. You know, I'm a veterinarian, and I see a lot of this breed with arthritis in their rear hip joints. I'll bring out some Rimadyl arthritis medicine for him. You should also consider feeding him dog food containing glucosamine, because it's helped a lot of other dogs with their painful joints.
Ritalin? How much will that cost? Dan asks as he grabs a feeler gauge to check his engine's spark plug gap.
No, Rimadyl, and it's no charge. My pleasure. By the way, what do you do for work?
I'm an airline mechanic out at San Francisco Airport. Normally, I help rebuild Pratt & Whitney turbine engines. I've been out there for about 24 years. I used to do line maintenance, you know, when a plane breaks down at the gate, but there are too many people asking questions about how soon the plane will be fixed. That gets annoying, so I like the engine shop now because it's a little more relaxed. I begin to cut open my cardboard boxes, trying not to look too much like a kid ripping open his presents. Airline mechanic, huh? I don't know why, and I've never really admitted this to anyone, but I hate riding in the back of those big planes. Last time I flew, I nearly freaked out. I just can't believe something so huge can fly, let alone stay together in turbulence. And I wonder how much the airlines are cutting costs these days. Dan finishes replacing his spark plugs and wipes his hands with a rag. You know, I've heard a lot of people have a fear of flying, more than most of us realize. I think it's like 1 in 6. I guess with some people it's a control issue. Trusting your life to someone you've never met is tough. I've known a number of airline pilots, and they're really the cream of the crop. The airlines are able to attract the best pilots because the job is so rewarding. I stop opening boxes to listen better and ask, so they're well qualified, you wouldn't worry about the skill level or training of the pilots? Dan replies, those guys go through so much training, retraining, and check rides that they stay really sharp. Every 6 months they've got to go through a tough medical exam too. They're human, but those guys know what they're doing. Though he eases my fear about the pilots a little, I bring up another concern. So explain how something that big gets off the ground and manages to stay together in bad turbulence. Dan's confidence in the subject matter is contagious. I'm grateful he's taking the time to share some of his knowledge, and we pass the time amicably. For the most part, I simply soak in all he has to say. Big airplanes fly the same as small ones. Basically, wings and some speed through the air is all that's required to make a plane fly. The plane is just moving through the air like swimming or surfing. Air's like water, a fluid. It's just a little thinner than water, but it's still a significant mass. Have you ever stuck your hand out the car window on the freeway? The faster you go, the thicker the air feels, right? To a plane traveling over 500 miles an hour, it feels like a thick fluid capable of substantial support. Jetliners look massive, but for their size, they are lightweight. For the most part, they're hollow, constructed primarily with lightweight aluminum. Just think of a soda can. Moving around his plane to check the adjustment of his handbrake, Dan goes on. As for the plane strength, the FAA mandates that jetliners are designed and built with large safety margins. Coming out of the factory, the planes are thoroughly flight tested before certification. Structurally, jet aircraft can withstand many times the stresses and forces which are imposed upon them in normal flight profiles. Jet lag's face contorts as Dan reaches down to scratch behind the dog's ears. The wing of an aircraft is incredibly strong. It's built as one continuous unit extending through the fuselage. It's constructed with huge reinforced spars. Unless they're flown at speeds far greater than normal, there is no way the wing of an aircraft can produce enough lift to damage its structure. This also applies to turbulence, because even severe turbulence won't harm an aircraft. The wings just can't produce enough of a lifting force to bend anything. With furrowed eyebrows, I say, that's what really bugs me, turbulence. People often misunderstand turbulence. When encountering turbulence, nervous passengers feel that the plane's falling out of the sky. It's natural for them to only feel the down bumps, but actually for every down bump, there's an up bump. The down bumps are just more easily noticed. Turbulence bad enough to spill drinks or cause you to fly up off your seat is extremely rare, but even if you do experience it, remember that the plane is not falling thousands of feet. It just hit a bump a couple of feet high. The altimeters in the cockpit would barely register the bump. According to the National Transportation Safety Board, there's never been a modern airliner that crashed because of turbulence alone. Turbulence may be annoying, even unnerving, but it can't make the wings break. Then I ask, but what about air pockets? Can't they be dangerous if a plane falls into one? Dan takes a deep breath, grins, and sighs. I don't know where the whole air pocket fabrication started, but there are no such things as air pockets. You can think of flying like being on a lake in a boat. Sometimes the lake waters are smooth, and sometimes they get stirred up from the wind or other planes. Riding on a choppy lake may be a bumpy ride. Sometimes you might encounter a big wave that jolts the boat. Riding down the side of a wave may give you the feeling you're dropping, but there are no holes or pockets in the water where the boat or plane is going to fall into. Air pockets are a myth, because planes don't just fall out of the sky. There's always air there to support them. Man, I declare, I wish I would have known some of that stuff before. I think you're starting to put me more at ease about flying on those big planes. Dan smartly replies, hey, it's no charge, Doc.
From the distance, the sound of a two-stroke engine becomes distinct. We look outside the hangar to see the bright blue sky has now morphed to a darker violet color as the sun is ducked behind the hills to the west. The silhouette of Rich's ultralight is apparent just above the horizon to the south. Descending to the runway, Rich eases the throttle back and his little plane's wheels softly kiss the welcoming grass carpet. He pulls up to the hangar with his propeller coasting to a stop. Rich is not alone. In the right seat, dressed in a cute pink snowsuit, is a little tow-headed blonde girl. She must be his daughter, and her ear-to-ear grin strains the limits of her facial muscles. Exiting the plane, they giggle to one another and tell of their adventure finding a hidden cave up in the foothills. His daughter is clutching interesting rocks and other artifacts found there. I don't know if I've ever witnessed a stronger display of love and connection than that which passed between this father and daughter. Now that I get the chance to formally meet Richard Hansen, I found out he's a vice president at a big telecommunications company. With all the seriousness of his business world, he likes to come out here to blow off a little steam with some, as Rich puts it, aeronautical silliness. While Dan and I help Rich put his plane to bed, I learn that Rich grew up in Montana and graduated from UC Berkeley. Rich never stops. He's a funny guy who's always quick with a joke. Rich could easily afford other aircraft, but says he prefers his little ultralight to any other plane he could think of. He loves the intimacy of low and slow flying, and says it's the closest you can come to flying like a bird without going through the whole reincarnation thing.